Hello, and welcome to Community Conversations. Community Conversations is a series of pre-recorded interviews lasting about 30 minutes and hosted here on KRFY 88.5 FM at 8 a.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. This recorded interim show is not a replacement for the morning show. We will bring you topics of current interest along with ongoing general information, as well as highlighting voices from our community. Please bear with us for any pauses caused by internet or Zoom connections. Finally, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that it is broadcast. Having said that, I'd like to introduce hosts. I am Julie Calamine of the KRFY Morning Show, and hello to my co-host, Phil Huff. Hi, Phil.
Hey, Julie, how are you?
I'm great. What have you been up to in the last week?
Well, I've had a couple of days off from work this week and went down to do some errands in Spokane and got a chance to take a nice long hike in the Dishman Hills area. Just a fabulous area if for some reason you find yourself in Spokane Valley with a few extra hours to spare.
It's worth the trip. Well, my week has really just been a little gardening in the cool weather, and I'm embarrassed to say I finally made it to the top of Chilicoe Peak. 5 years in the area, and it's been that long for me to get there, but it was beautiful.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. Well, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our topic and our guest. This morning we're going to be interviewing Brian Brooks, who is the Executive Director of the Idaho Wildlife Federation. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes, happy to have you. So, Brian, you are the Executive Director of the Idaho Wildlife Federation, and that's based out of Boise. Let's start by hearing a bit about you, your background, your personal experiences that allowed you to become the Executive Director for this organization.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Idaho. My family moved here when I was really young, 5, and I'm not allowed to say where we moved from. So we'll keep that a mystery for Idahoans. No, I moved here when I was 5. And my family was incredibly outdoorsy. We grew up taking summers off. My mom worked in public schools, so we had lots of summers off with her. And my dad made it a point to take work off 2-3 weeks at a time, pull the tent trailer, put the canoe on top of it. And we would go on these really long road trips in the summer where we would fly fish in Idaho, go up north into Montana, and then we'd swoop down into Wyoming, into Colorado, and then into Utah and come back. And then next season is fall, and we would start hunting birds and big game, and there was outdoors activity, or outdoor activities aplenty in Idaho, and it really took us to every corner of the state exploring our public lands. And I went to college up at U of I, and the University of Idaho. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, so I started out as a journalism major, and it's something just wasn't really clicking. And my advisor told me very wisely to just go do something I enjoy for the weekend. So I went camping, did some fishing, came back. He asked what I did. I said, oh, well, I went camping and did some fishing. He's like, you know, I have some people that you should talk to in the College of Natural Resources. So I graduated with a major in conservation social science, which is the sort of human dimensions of conservation initiatives. And I graduated in 2010, and the job market wasn't really quite recovered yet. And I had some time on my hands while I was bartending and decided I should probably go back to school. And I wanted to focus more on, I really wanted to buff up my hard science and also kind of policy. I realized really early on that it was, you know, science is really important to maybe restore a lot of ecosystems that have been degraded that I have actually seen personally while I was growing up. But then I realized it was probably really bad government policy that allowed us to get to those points where we needed to clean up, do some restoration in those landscapes. And so I then started focusing on policy. And I graduated, I got my master's in about 2015 and did some kind of like hard construction in salmon and steelhead habitat out of state, and came back and had this opportunity presented to me with the Idaho Wildlife Federation. And it was, there's a lot of history with the Federation if we want to get into that now. That might work.
Yeah, we can certainly want to get into that, but it sounds like you had a passion and a really wise advisor and were able to channel that into an education, and probably not knowing what the job would be. Oftentimes when people do that, the job finds them. And
yeah, I know. Yeah, that was it fell into my lap, and I'm not sure how many college students that really happens to, where you graduate with a sense of this is exactly what I want to do. And, you know, growing up, instilled in myself and my two brothers, our parents, you know, they maybe implicitly taught us to stand up for what we believe in and to not be silent about those things. And so I think there was a combination of growing up and knowing how important the outdoors were to me, and the pursuit of fish and wildlife and harvesting your own meat and knowing where it comes from, being responsible for it. I think it made kind of, it's a perfect storm. So now I fight for fish and wildlife and the wild places that Idahoans enjoy.
So tell us about the match. How does your experience match up with the Idaho Wildlife Federation, its history and mission?
Yeah, so the Wildlife Federation is actually the oldest statewide conservation organization in the state of Idaho. It was founded in 1936 by sportsmen and sportswomen who were really discontented with the state of Idaho's fish and wildlife populations. They were just kind of tired of sitting by and seeing these really destructive policies, or lack of policies back then. All these different organizations around the state, rod and gun clubs, wildlife clubs, and they realized there was this backing, this sort of social and political backing, but they weren't organized. And so there was this big wildlife summit back in 1936. And that was initiated by some folks from Idaho who went to the General Wildlife Assembly that was convened in 1936 by FDR and a few other, Ding Darling and a few other notable conservationists of the time. And they formed the National Wildlife Federation.
So those Where folks was that Idaho. Meeting? Was the meeting in Idaho or was it
no,
elsewhere?
It was in Washington, D.C.
Got it.
Yeah, yeah. There's pictures of that in one of the hotels it was formed in. But so the Idaho delegates came back to Idaho and said, we need to do this exact same thing, but on a state level. And actually, you saw the formation of state wildlife federations across the entire country. And that was there was an idea that was sparked at that meeting that, you know, we should really not be managing our wildlife and habitat by partisan whims. We should have... You know, there was this emerging ecology science and biology science at the time. And they said, you know, these are the people who should be informing our decisions, not only informing our decisions, but making the decisions. And, but that was really impossible because back then, the Idaho governor would appoint a state game warden. And that was a really toxic, politically fraught relationship. And you had, elk tags going out to political donors in maybe areas where there were really, trophy quality elk, but in places where we really shouldn't have been harvesting them because the numbers weren't so great or something like that. So the Idaho Wildlife Federation formed and came together and asked the state legislature to pass a law that would form an independent sort of Department of Fish and Game. And the legislature rebuked them. And so the Federation said, in 2 years, you're going to have a response. And for 2 years, they organized. And the result of that organization was the passage of the first Citizens Initiative of Idaho, a ballot measure that was voted on. It passed by about 76% to form an independent Department of Fish and Game Commission, where the commission would be directing the Department of Fish and Game, creating seasons for fish and wildlife, where we should be putting funds to recover habitat and all that kind of stuff. And that's the system we've had for over 80 years now.
Wow. And
yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. So the Wildlife Federation was really instrumental in creating the system that we have today. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's called it's referred to as the North American model of wildlife conservation. It's a user pays model where if you want to take, or can it's a consumptive use of wildlife that you should pay into the system that you're benefiting from. And that's why we pay for fishing licenses. That's why we pay for hunting tags and all that kind of stuff.
Well, let's move on to the mission today. We've heard quite a bit about the history, but how has that history brought us up until today and the mission, what you're working on?
Yeah, throughout the years, we've engaged on a number of environmental or wildlife or conservation issues. Of course, the definition of all those things are quite fluid, but our fingerprints can be found all over the landscape of Idaho. You know, we fought to keep the Middle Fork of the Salmon River undammed. We helped delineate the boundaries of the Frank Church Wilderness, and that's all pretty historical stuff now. And bringing us to present day, I was hired in 2016 to sort of re-energize the organization. What can be pretty typical in statewide nonprofits, not just conservation-oriented nonprofits, is just organizations ebb and flow, depending on who's, you know, around at the time. And I was just, I didn't have a lot of experience. I was educated, and they wanted somebody who was young and hungry to take on a lot of the, and put back the, kind of the found, rebuild the foundation of, necessary for any organization. And so in the last 4 years, I've been on for almost 5 years come January, we have hired on three other employees, and we are about to hire on a fifth employee. And I have to, in some ways, credit the sort of advocacy vacuum that has existed in Idaho for the last sort of 20 years for sportsmen and women. There's a lot of really great organizations that advocate for conservation in Idaho, but there really wasn't a niche yet, an organization that really specifically represented hunters and anglers. And so we thought it was really important that we sort of separate ourselves, that we don't compete with the very good other organizations that were out there. And so that's where we are now. And we work on several issues that are really topical these days.
Sure. I've been to your website and I've noticed you've got four sort of four prongs you work on. Shall we go through them in that order? I know access is number one.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure that one is more important than the other. Because we are a wildlife organization, we can start with wildlife, and that might inform why access is so important. So number one, if you want to enjoy wildlife for whatever the reason, if it's a consumptive purpose, to put meat in the freezer, or if it's just to enjoy them, you have to support policies, that get, just keep the wildlife on the landscape. And that means that we also have to advocate for their habitat. Wildlife need space, and they need food, and they need water. So we need quality habitat for wildlife. And a lot of that habitat is provided by public lands. And unfragmented habitat is really important to wildlife, especially migrating wildlife, and public lands in the West really provide that contiguous and connectivity. And of course, private land is also important. We can't rule that out, and we do work on some private land issues. And then on top of all that, so that's kind of the pyramid. And then on top of the pyramid is that we, from the human standpoint, we want access to those things. So public lands provide that kind of unfettered access to go and enjoy nature, whether you're hunting or bird watching or just picking berries, morels, whatever. But also access to the wildlife for hunting and fishing. So access to reservoirs for waterfowling and all that kind of stuff. So access is kind of the top of the pyramid. And when we say access, of course, we mean access to the land and access to the wildlife. And I think it's also important to recognize too that, you know, that access is a very egocentric sort of terminology, but we also recognize the importance of wildlife having their own space. And there are important reasons to set aside, for instance, waterfowling habitat, wildlife refuges, where you can really give them their own space to breed, to raise young and all that kind of stuff too. So there's a really important balance there.
There's a lot to unpack with public lands and public policy, where you know, there's a real clear need for an advocacy group like yours to help inform good public policy. But on the question of access, before we get to there, tell us more about some of the unique programs to assure that there is access across private land, some of the incentives for landowners or cooperative arrangements with landowners to make sure there's a provision for access.
Yeah, absolutely. There are some state programs and there are some federal programs that can help the general public gain access to private lands. And that is always at the discretion of the private landowner. I think that's important to say upfront that it's always a willing participation by the landowner. We're not trying to force any private landowner to give us access to their lands. But on the state side, we have several fish and game sort of processes to get access. We have Access Yes, which is all of these programs actually by Fish and Game are funded exclusively by sportsman dollars through fishing and hunting licenses and tags and all of that. But they benefit all of the public, the recreating public. So Access Yes is a program through Fish and Game that pays landowners, rewards landowners for providing access to their property. You do not need to be hunting to access that property. In some states, it's only open to hunters. And there's another access fund that was recently created by the Fish and Game that is not Access Yes, but it's more about paying larger landowners in Idaho. So typically like private timber properties that maybe Access Yes is not a large enough pool of funding from. So we have this new access program that'll pay larger timber companies, typically in North Idaho, that will guarantee access for people to recreate on those large tracts of land. And then we have some other programs that are federal, like the Land Water Conservation Fund, the Forest Legacy Fund. Those are federal pools of money that can, with willing seller, willing buyer kind of situations, where you can buy conservation easements for private land. So the land stays in private hands. When that land is sold in the deed, it will say, you know, in forever, in perpetuity, these lands have to be, you know, they can only have this much development. They have to stay open for this much habitat, all that kind of stuff. Just recently, of course, and you can help me with the name of it, but there was the Forest Legacy Funds that were used to preserve the, about 13,000 acres up near Coeur d'Alene. It was Stimson Lumber, and it was they were going to sell it to a developer, and they were going to make luxury homes and an equestrian loop, and it was habitat that was occupied by elk, whitetail, black bear, cougar, and that was going to be developed. And so Forest Legacy Funds were used. Basically, the development rights of that land were purchased, and they will stay in Stimson's hands in private ownership, but it will remain as a functioning timber forest, but it also will allow public access forever.
For listeners who are catching that, that was the Clagstone Meadows property that's been under some discussion for a number of years. And as Brian's just mentioned, the Forest Legacy Fund was a huge component of being able to assure public access to those lands in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm. And it's near Rastrum, right, Phil? Is it the Rastrum
Correct.
Mountain yeah. area?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, I apologize for that. Yeah, Rastrum.
But Brian, I'm interested in knowing what is the Idaho Wildlife Federation's connection then with access, because you're explaining these programs, but how do you all get involved? Through lobbying or explain that to me.
Typically, classic lobbying and grassroots support. So it's always in conjunction with some government entity, whoever that is. If we can identify a really important piece of property, we will go to who we believe is the proper government entity to begin discussions about that. And we work really in tandem. So we're kind of helping to steer where we should direct some of these available funding sources. And it's also important to note that until the Great American Outdoors to act, and if that's passed or not, that sometimes this funding is not always available. So there's not like an unlimited pool of funding available. But yeah, we will we'll work with the government agency to not only identify the property, but see how much it'll cost, other organizations that are more suited to talk to the landowner. I mean, we work with our partner organizations as well, see who has relationships with the current landowner. And so it's kind of like a meet and greet for a while. And then it's a matter of actually finding the funding. And then it's a matter of pushing it through the legislature. And the way you do that is you deliver grassroots support and show that it is actually supported by the people who are being represented by legislators who need to approve it. So yeah, it's
so not to open up too many cans of worms here, but there have been a couple controversial topics in the last year or two that I believe your organization has weighed in on that would threaten access. And maybe we can break each of them down. There was a trespass law that created some restrictions on, or potential restrictions on access. And I believe there was some issue with road closures on independent lands where easements should suggest they wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. So pick either one of those and start where you'd like.
Goody. Yeah, we are right in the thick of both of those issues. I'll start with maybe the easier one, the road access issue. There was some out-of-state interests that came into Idaho and bought nearly 200,000 acres of private property. It was already private property. It belonged to a large timber company. The Texas boys, the Wilkes brothers, came in and bought it, and that's fine. It was a private-to-private transfer, but they started shutting down roads that people had used for, in some instances, generations. And those roads were really, in our opinion, in the opinion of many others, not theirs to close. So it's a really interesting sort of legal deep dive here. But if a road was built with public resources, tax dollars, and it was maintained with tax dollars, and it was used by the taxpayer for a certain amount of time, it fulfills what's called prescriptive road easements. Nearly all the Western states have some sort of language about prescriptive roads in statutory code. And that was because, the Eastern states sort of learned right away that, people could make this road, this path of least resistance, say on a valley floor. And then when folks were kind of settling the land, it was a really good idea to settle the land where that road would go through. And then you could basically block that road and then charge people to go through your land. And so they started creating these prescriptive easements, basically saying, it's actually in the best interest of the states for commerce reasons to allow these sort of routes to just remain in as a public resource, as an easement that overlays the private property. And then some of these roads actually have recorded easements in the deeds. And so, we've worked to identify those. And it turns out it's not just the guys from Texas that are closing down these roads that they don't have the right to close down. It's actually happening all over the place. If anybody who has spent a lot of time in the sagebrush or in the woods, especially hunting, you find a lot of no trespassing signs or private road signs on roads that you think you know are actually public lands and roads. And we have a law in Idaho that actually says, you're not allowed to communicate that any public land is actually closed or private or anything like that. But there's some issues with how we can actually enforce that. And so IWF has been a vocal proponent for changing that law so that citizens can actually enforce it. And we were inundated with phone calls and emails about these instances of public lands being posted as private and public roads being posted or like physically blocked, that we had to basically create a rewards program for people to pursue these road closures themselves. We're a four-person nonprofit at the moment. And I mean, it's something we hear about nearly weekly. So if someone can do all the investigation themselves and they can get that road open back up, we compensate them. That was just the best way we found to deal with it.
And it's kind of a nice reward. I thought I noticed around $500. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, $500. And, in some instances, if you can just get the road open back up, we will put you in a drawing for a really nice hunting rifle. You don't have to accept the rifle. You could take the cash if you wanted to. But if you can actually get a conviction, which is what we're looking for, and the conviction is not to punish the person who's responsible, it's to just to have the law have some equity here. And we can talk about that equity when we talk about the trespass law. it was really just to enforce access issues. Yeah. And really, yeah.
Well, we've got a number of topics to cover, but it's great that you're helping advocate for keeping public lands open and prevent folks from posting lands that shouldn't be posted. I think that's great. But I think in order to cover everything we want to cover this hour, I'm going to move us along. And so I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your work in the legislatures, the state and the federal. It sounds like you're very active in the state legislature. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, we're the only full-time sportsman and wildlife lobbyist in the state that looks just at these issues. So that is our full-time job. And in Idaho, compared to other states, we have relatively few conservation and environmental lobbyists. So it's actually a pretty small community.
Mm-hmm. And this is where the trespass issue came up. It was a state law that was recently enacted. And so in a real brief way, describe what happened there.
Yeah. There's, I guess I want to preface this by saying, it's political checkers to always, go after your opposition by naming them this or that. And we were named as, anti-private property rights or anything like that. But we really had some real concerns with the trespass law that passed in 2018 now, that were actually shared by the Police Chiefs Association, the Idaho Sheriff's Association, the Prosecuting Attorneys Association, and they were all pretty practical. But the problems were with those, basically, it upped the fines for trespassing, which were fine. We actually testify that we're not here to defend people who are willfully trespassing. But what the law did is it included a fee shifting provision. Typically, when you go to civil court, the prevailing party is awarded their attorney's fees. So you're not really financially damaged by being found innocent and accused of something. The new law is that if you are sued and you are found innocent, it is incumbent upon you to prove to another jury that you deserve your legal fees compensated back to you. So it's kind of a dangerous precedent. Basically, you have to prove that the lawsuit was brought without footing. So in these kind of smaller courts where the judge might be neighbors with someone who's accusing you, it kind of creates a conflict of interest there. So yeah, you could be, and if you have, are familiar with some of these court cases that can be dragged on, it can cost upwards of $50,000 to just defend yourself from an accusation, and you may not get that money back if you are found innocent. So that's really dangerous. So if you are wondering by private property, but you're on public, say you're pheasant hunting, pheasants like to follow fence lines. There's a little bit more weeds there. And someone doesn't like that you're hunting by their property. Say they just don't like that they hear your gunshots, but you have every right to be there. They could sue you and say that you were trespassing and you maybe weren't. And anyways, it's a real mess. And it also includes it blurred the lines for posting private property. So here we are significantly increasing the fines for trespassing. Innocent people may not be able to get their legal fees returned to them if proven innocent. And at the same time, it basically says you don't have to post your property every 660 feet anymore. You just have to do it in a conspicuous manner. So,
sure. So what has the Federation been able to do about that? You're just bringing it to the public's attention, or were you able to modify the law? What is the outcome?
We were able to modify the law twice. It's still not a good law. It was still opposed by the Sheriffs and Police Chiefs Association, the very people who are in charge of enforcing the laws that the legislature makes. But we were able to amend it twice, and it was certainly made better. We let sportsmen know, hey, there's this really dangerous law for people that recreate on public lands and recreate close to private lands. And because of our, we got the information out there, we asked sportsmen, what do you want to say to your legislators? And so we provide the tools with people across the state to communicate to their legislators, I don't like this about the law, I do like this about the law, that kind of thing. So we were able to amend it. The legislature actually said, okay, look, we realize, we understand we didn't pass a perfect law. We can address this the next session. They have yet to fulfill that promise.
It's good to have that voice there, and these issues are complex, and nobody wants to advocate for trespassing, but everyone wants a good law that all can live by and stay in compliance, and so thank you for your service. What are some of the other issues that you're working on with the legislature right now or that you see coming up in the near future?
Yeah, well, for the last 2 years, we've been working on a bill that we call the Public Access Protection Act, PAPA, as we refer to it, and I mentioned this earlier. Right now, if you post public property as private, or you physically block a public road and put up a private sign, you don't allow people to use a road that they have every right to use. The violation is criminal, which means that you don't have the right to take them to somebody to civil court. The problem with this is that the people who are need to sort of enforce a criminal law, that's the county, it's the sheriff, it's the county prosecutors, they have a laundry list, a litany of issues that they have to basically enforce. And a locked gate or a sign where it shouldn't be, rightfully so, falls through the cracks to the bottom of the priority list, because they have a lot of, you can think of all the heinous crimes that are out there that are being committed. And it's also a resource issue. A lot of these rural counties are strapped for cash, and they just can't justify derailing their budget for 10 years by going after billionaires who are posting public land as private. And much like private property trespass laws that exist now, we thought we should have the ability to take these violators to civil court. Remove the middlemen completely. The inability of counties to get involved on this for practical and realistic reasons. Why don't we just settle this peer to peer in court, like we can do with private property trespass? And you wouldn't believe how scary of an idea that is for some people. And so we've been communicating for 2 years now that that's probably the best way that we should solve these issues. A lot of lawyers agree with us that maybe these kinds of issues should never have been in criminal court, that we shouldn't have a sheriff poring over deeds, investigating whether roads are private or public, that this should be solved on our own dime, the citizen's dime, and we shouldn't be wasting government time with it. So that's one bill that we're working on, and that's proactive. But in the Idaho legislature, we end up playing a lot of defense. There are a lot of ideas out there that turn into bills that impact wildlife in a negative way, impact terrestrial and aquatic habitat in a bad way, and would compromise our ability to enjoy public lands as well. So we end up fighting a lot of bad bills more than we end up fighting for good bills.
Yep. Defense. Yes.
Defense. always on defense.
So talk to us about it. Back in the 30s, the organization you represent helped to form Idaho Department of Fish and Game. Bring us forward to the current time. What's your relationship like with them now? How do you work with them?
That's a really great question. If you can imagine, things are a lot more politicized these days. And I think that for all nonprofits, the way they engage with their relative government agencies, it's a lot more careful. It's a lot less, maybe chummy isn't the right word, but a lot of government agencies are under the microscope. And that is a result of decades and decades of what some people may call really good behavior and what other people may call really bad behavior. But for one reason or another, agencies have to be really careful to not be seen as taking any political stances or not. So a lot of people view that the Department of Fish and Game has been muzzled in certain ways on their ability to speak out for what is good for wildlife or what is bad for wildlife. And there is a really strong lever that the legislature can pull if they think that they are being a little too political or a little bit too much of an advocate for one thing or another. And that is that they control the funding of the Fish and Game. They approve the budget, at least. And so, we have a good relationship with Fish and Game. It's very professional, but they have to only provide technical assistance to the questions that we might ask or any collaborative processes that we may be involved with them. So they have to be really careful. But the role that the Federation plays is that we can actually be an advocate and we can actually fight for sportsmen, for wildlife, where Fish and Game cannot. And so we have a good professional relationship. They have a lot of scientific knowledge and they are the folks who are on the ground and we are the beneficiaries of their work. And so we respect what they do. Idaho is known as the opportunity state. We have lots of diverse hunting and fishing and wildlife viewing opportunities because of the good work of the department. And so we really view our role as defending their work, making sure they can get it done without political interjection from the legislature or any other politicians who may have some sort of different agenda.
Okay, and does the Idaho Wildlife Federation have a seat at the table with Idaho Fish and Game? And if so, how is that? Are you able to affect policy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're certainly, we don't operate in, it's not just us. We have a lot of partner organizations that work with Fish and Game. I think Fish and Game does a really good job of being fair to everybody, even organizations who may say, like, be very critical of Fish and Game. Fish and Game is always, and they might be obligated to do so, just their fiduciary obligation to hear all people, but they are really fair. And we always have a seat at the table, mostly because Fish and Game is just really good at fulfilling that obligation to hear from all of the public. But because we represent sportsmen, because we have a really good finger on the pulse of what sportsmen might think about this or that, we tend to have a good ear with them.
And what are some of the issues that you're working with Fish and Game on that are of high priority for the Federation?
Well, we are working on a number of issues. Down here in southern Idaho, closer to Boise, we have the Boise River Wildlife Management Area. Wildlife management areas are Department of Fish and Game properties. We have the Boise River Wildlife Management Area is actually holds wintering habitat for Idaho's largest mule deer herd and about 2,000 elk as well as some other upland game birds. But right now we have incremental development of recreational trails from the growing population of Boise, which is the fastest growing city in the country. There's sort of piecemeal developing into this mule deer habitat. And so in that instance, that's very favored, very supported sort of wildlife protections in that area. We're bringing, making sure that we are leading the charge to make sure that we are not just simply developing that area simply for recreation, mountain biking, all other sorts of stuff you can do. So we're working with Fish and Game to kind of organize how we can best not just stop the development into that region, but how we can maybe work with the mountain bikers to find a place where we can put a trail that doesn't impact or bisect this really large mule deer migration. In okay. Eastern Idaho, you know, we're working on some other migration issues, but there's examples all over the state. If we want to go deeper into those, we can.
Sure. Well, I think since we're broadcasting from Sandpoint, it might be a good time to talk a little bit about your Northern Idaho staff and if there are any projects that you're working on, working with Fish and Game or with the state up in our area.
Sure. Well, I know that some people are going to take offense to this, but we have a North Idaho field coordinator, but she lives in Grangeville. So I know that folks in Sandpoint do not consider that North Idaho. So for the sake of this argument or conversation, we call her the Central North Idaho Field Representative for the Idaho Wildlife Federation. But right now, we're working on, I think the biggest issue now is we're working on the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest Revision Plan. Every few decades, a national forest will go through a revision plan process where they sort of reassess the social values, the ecological values that are on the forest, and it kind of sets the management plan for the next 20 or 30 years. And right now, the Nez Clear Forest is, of course, going through that. So, Fish and Game may have their own comments. They're typically, as I said, they're not really an advocate role. They provide a lot of science and technical language. So we've been working hand in hand with them to help inform our comments. And again, they're really professional about that. They just didn't give us the science of like some area, you know, like this part of this is really good elk calving habitat. They have the scientific data, like collaring data. So then we can tell, you know, the National Forest, we think that if we want to promote more elk habitat, like we should do prescribe these, you know, prescriptions over here. And if there's salmon and steelhead rearing and spawning habitat, we should not be maybe logging within a quarter mile of these streams if we want to protect the that resource there. So that's maybe the most prescient issue in North Idaho, but I still understand that maybe Sandpoint doesn't see that the Nez Clear Forest is North Idaho. Right now, all the way up there, Clagstone Meadows was really the most sort of significant thing. We're not involved in the Grizzly Bear Road issue up there, to be honest, as a four-person staff, we just don't have the capacity to work on everything.
Oh, but we're growing. And the issues you've mentioned are statewide in many parts, so we do appreciate the statewide focus. And I think there's been some stuff in the news lately, or conversations at least, about the appointment process for commissioners and retention and reappointment process. And we could spend a lot of time on that, but mm-hmm. can you condense that really complex topic down into a few bits of information useful to our listeners?
I will try my hardest, Phil. Okay, so when the Wildlife Federation created the Fish and Game Commission, because of the partisan interjection into wildlife management, it just isn't working. It wasn't working. There's no such thing as a Republican mule deer or a Democrat cutthroat trout. They just need what they need. And back then, it was really important that with the creation of a commission, it would be nonpartisan. And how do you make something nonpartisan? It's kind of a reverse psychology thing here, but basically they said of the seven commissioners, no more than four could be of one political party. And that sounds like you're making it partisan, but by making it at least in some way balanced, it actually kind of removes politics from the commission. So one governor who appoints the commissioners can't just, you know, steamroll and fire all the old commissioners and say, all right, well, now I want everybody who's just in my political party. So that kind of protects, insulates it from those political shifts.
You can't pack the court, so to speak.
Yes, absolutely. You can't pack the court. And what we saw for this last legislative session, outgoing Representative Paul Shepard from Riggins introduced a bill that would remove the party declaration of commissioners. And again, it was sort of messaged in this way that, well, you know, your political affiliation really shouldn't matter for managing wildlife. And I believe that wholeheartedly, but that is why that clause exists in it. That's why we want them to declare their political affiliation, so we can always have a good mix in there, because there are some people in one political party who don't want the other side to have total control. And then it's the same for the other side of the aisle. They don't want the other party. So, and if you've looked at how often the governor has changed political parties in Idaho since Idaho's statehood, we've had 15 partisan changes. And that would mean that we would have 15 political, you know, differences in how we should manage wildlife. And we really want to avoid a change in how we manage wildlife every time there's a switch between a Democrat and a Republican governor. And so we really saw that as an attack on the core values of not only protecting or insulating wildlife from political mismanagement, but we also saw it as an attack on the North American model of wildlife conservation. All of these states across the whole country have these mandates to have just to keep the legislature and politicians away from wildlife management. And we saw this as a clear sort of violation of interjecting politics into our commission form of wildlife management.
So did the Federation then propose a model for fish and game commissioner selection? What are you advocating for?
Well, it has worked. The current model has worked for about 83 years. So Idaho's wild. Go ahead.
You'd like the status quo to, the Federation is okay, is fine with the current system, basically.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. No system is perfect, of course, but the current system has resulted in the proliferation of wildlife across the state. And I'm not speaking to anything that has to deal with, you know, the Endangered Species Act or any part of those sort of controversial aspects, okay. But the commission itself. I mean, there was one commissioner who came out and they usually do not go rogue, but Commissioner Atterbury came out and said, this is a bad idea. The system, it's not broken. The barn is not burning down, but it was really seen as a result of Commissioner Melton, who was a commissioner very briefly. He was appointed from the Clearwater region. He had been a lifelong Republican and then changed his affiliation, I think, to independent, not Democrat.
I think unaffiliated. Yeah. I think he was unaffiliated.
Yes. Unaffiliated. And so, you know, that was Governor Little saw it as against the spirit of the creation of the commission, of a system, against the spirit of a system that has worked for 83 years. Now, some people may gripe about decisions that the commission has made, but at least it's been in this structure that insulates wildlife from politics, but maybe not insulating wildlife from personal, but small kind of complaints that people
have. So his switch to unaffiliated made him ineligible to be appointed again, or?
It actually made him eligible, but it was publicized that he had been affiliated as a Republican the entire time, which, you know, it didn't look good for Governor Little, who campaigned on transparency. And when this came to light that Melton was not actually unaffiliated or an independent or a Democrat, I think it was just Governor Little was trying to honor the original intent of the 1938 initiative.
Yes, the true intent, and not have folks that are truly Republicans register as unaffiliated and then be appointed. So I agree. I think that's what Governor Little was trying to correct.
Yeah. And we really looked at this bill as it was looking, there was just no problem, really. And again, it's not a perfect system, but this is not the way to, there was no help needed.
Another good example of a defensive action necessary. So as we come close to the time we have, are there any hot button issues that you want to share or any upcoming events?
Yeah, let's see here. We have a federal piece of legislation, the Great American Outdoors Act, is a bill that is co-sponsored by Representative Simpson. It passed through the Senate already with only 17 no votes of 100. Unfortunately, two of Idaho's senators voted against it. And what this bill will do is it will fund the massive backlog of maintenance needs in our national parks, and as well, and the reason we really support this, because we don't have any national parks in Idaho, it also funds some maintenance backlog needs with the Forest Service and BLM lands, and that's a lot of our public lands in Idaho. So, I mean, if you like access, if you like getting out there and you want good roads and bridges to help get you into the backcountry, you should be supporting this bill. The bill also fully funds permanently the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which has benefited every single county in Idaho. That funds diversity projects from municipal swimming pools to funding fishing access sites. WMAs have been purchased in southern Idaho, the Hagerman WMA, the entire acreage of Hagerman WMA, which is in a sea of private. If you don't own private land down there, you actually have this little public parcel that you can go hunt on because of Land Water Conservation Fund. So that should be coming up in front of the House really soon, and we hope it passes. That will be a generational positive bill for conservation.
All right, and how can listeners help you advocate for that? Do they go directly to their own senator or congressperson, or go to you guys?
Yeah, you know, at this point, if you're in District 2 over here in southern and east Idaho, contact Congressman Simpson and tell him thank you for supporting this. You know, they need pats on the back as much as they need a stick or a carrot. If you live in District 1 in Congressman Fulcher's district, then contact his office and ask him to vote yes for the bill. And okay. Of course, if you want to learn about more issues outside of just that, you can follow the Idaho Wildlife Federation on Facebook. That's free. You can sign up for our email. That's also free. And if you really like our work, you can become a member. That's not free, but it goes to a good cause.
Okay. And what's the person would just go Facebook Idaho Wildlife Federation and find you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And what about a website, or would you prefer everyone go to Facebook?
No, the website works just as well. You can learn more about the work that we work on probably from our website, and that is www.idahowildlife.org.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's been wonderful chatting with you this morning. Brian Brooks from the Idaho Wildlife Federation. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you. And
this has been a recorded show for Community Conversations played here at 88.5 FM KRFY. You can listen to the podcast at krfy.org. We'll remind you again, this was recorded a few days before its broadcast. Not that a lot of the information we've talked about is going to change, but always good to check sources and, of course, check out the information that Brian's given us for Idaho Wildlife Federation. Thank you.
Thank you.